Welcome to this edition of the Bear's Den podcast. I'm Matt Bear. Before I get to the next guest, I want to take this time to thank everyone that has been listening over the past few months. I've really enjoyed doing each and every episode and sharing the stories of others with you. It's been very humbling to hear from some of you through text, email, or calls that have enjoyed listening and hearing from the guests that I've had on. I want you to know that it means a lot, and I'm grateful to all of you. Today, I've got to bring the energy, as this guest that I'm having on has a lot of it. He is a professional coach and speaker for individuals, teams, and companies. He has worked with players and teams in the NBA, WNBA, G League, and at the college and high school levels. He is also an author of the book titled Uncommon Competitor, One Day Contracts. And he is Scott Savor. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Excited, Matt. Let's get after it, sir.
Let's go. Let's go. As you know, Scott, you and I have known each other for a couple years now. You're a Crosby guy. I'm an Aiken guy. We're bitter rivals. You're a little bit older than me, so I didn't get to play against you. But it's been kind of fun, you know, following you and seeing your career path. And could you maybe just give us a peek into what your career path has been like, Scott, kind of, you know, where you went, you know, from graduating from Crosby and kind of the days leading up to where you're at now?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. I've been extremely spoiled. I always tell people, like, sometimes my waking, so obviously grew up in a town, you know, a small town, 500 people, Deerwood, Minnesota, right down the street from Aiken Gobbler Town. But, you know, played hoops, a lot of fun stuff. Went to JUCO for a couple of years, played D2 basketball, and then played in the ABA a little bit after that 6 years later. But kind of carved out a path and professionally in strength conditioning. Got the intern with the Minnesota Vikings, Randy Moss's first year, and then continue on working with them for 3 years. And I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I was very, very fortunate to be around some really smart people in the NFL in performance at a very early age. And if there's any lessons for anybody who's younger, who's listening to this, you have to get in with people who are smarter than you immediately. And you have to embrace that lack of courage or lack of confidence, no matter how old you are, no matter how much skills you have. So that kind of was a launching pad for me getting into the NFL early, and then was a strength coach for a while. Got to kind of travel all over and work for a lot of different platforms, and then start my own business 12 years ago. Now I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, and you had some stops in there at the collegiate level, Scott, with, I believe, University of Detroit and then also Tennessee, and you know, got to be around Pat Summitt and the women's basketball team and some of the success they had there. How impactful was being around someone like Coach Summitt?
Unbelievable. So I believe the end goal in life, though, is to be able to learn from anyone, right? And there are certain exaggerations or experiences that stick out more than others, obviously. And, yo, I believe the goal is to wake up every morning and suck everyone's brains dry. You know that, so it doesn't matter. But Summitt was unbelievable. I'll never forget sitting in her house, and I've told the story a million times for my interview. And I said, you know, Pat, for whatever reason, if this position doesn't work out, what would you teach me? What are a couple of truths that you've identified in life? And she goes, number one, surround yourself by people who you trust their skills enough to change your mind. People don't do that enough. They just hire puppets or they hire people who are like-minded, and there's no really normalized conflict whatsoever, and nobody can disagree ever because you just hire people who you like. But I thought that was big time. And then she said, never graduate ever. Like, there's a reason why. There's a reason why you should be a sponge on steroids every day and never, ever graduate. So those things smacked me in the mouth pretty hard. And just watching her lead by example was amazing.
That's great. And you mentioned, you know, now that you have your own business, Scott, what's it like being in charge of your own day, and why is that important, you know, to you to have that kind of autonomy?
Yeah, great question. So most people in their life, I really believe, don't get close to the autonomy that they would like or hope for ever. It's just a reality. But the reality with that, though, is this: it takes tremendous courage, planning, and laser-like focus on a daily basis, because any part of my business could be gone tomorrow, and I have to be professionally and emotionally and all that good stuff able to be able to pivot or handle or be agile to any of that stuff. So I started my business, I think, earlier than maybe I should have. I could have planned even more, but I've been very fortunate to have, you know, support system in the family and my wife and so that I can pivot and course correct or be agile inside the industry that I'm fortunate to be involved in. So it's been unbelievable.
And you and I, whenever we get together, Scott, I really just enjoy our conversations, you know, questions, the learning, the speaking and hearing from you about your different adventures that you have going on. And one thing that I really, you know, admire about you is just the passion and fire that you bring with you each day. What do you hang out with people or converse with people that don't have passion?
So again, it's all subjective, right? So I don't walk on water. I don't wear sandals. I don't, you know what I mean? So I'm not perfect at anything, but I do believe in high standards as it relates to energy, passion, enthusiasm. And I try to flip it. So there's a great book out there, Atomic Habits. It's called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And one thing he talks about is creating a day inside of all of your transitions that we have where certain things trigger certain behaviors. So if I look at someone who I joke respectfully and might say, on my opinion, is a dead corpse. They walk around with no energy. They walk around with lower than resting heart rate type stuff, you know, whatever, you know what I'm talking about. But
yep.
I use that as a trigger to hopefully crank me up and self-start me even more versus crank start me up like I believe the majority of the world is. I mean, everyone, a lot of people watch Walking Dead, the TV series on TV, but it's like you walk out into the real world and it's still the Walking Dead, even though you turn the stupid TV off. So I just really believe energy introduces us to others before we even open our mouth. And it's really just a really big deal. And hopefully I demonstrate that in an appropriate way.
And, you know, with that, Scott, I know a big thing for you is learning, you know, continuously learning, you know, either on your own or from others. How are you these days continuing to learn yourself?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Again, this is like oxygen to me. It's ripped a heart on my chest. It's changed my life in the most unbelievable way, personally and professionally. I literally get angry and frustrated if I don't learn something new tonight before I go to sleep. It just drives me nuts. But again, the ROI for me has been ridiculous. So I used to think that reading books was the best way to learn. And there's no question for a period of like 6 years, I'd read like one of three books cover to cover every day. Completely out of control, Matt. Completely out of control. And we've talked about this various forms of the story, but it's like I got hit by a bright light. And it doesn't mean I'm better than anyone. I just was fortunate to pay attention to something that I thought was important and then became completely obsessed with it. Completely obsessed. And I believe obsessed is a really, really good word as long as you tame that behavior and make sure you monitor it in a healthy way. But I believe in order to really ever change ourselves at a high level, personally, professionally, you got to get obsessed with something. Almost to a point where it drives other people just nutso who's around you. It just drives them nuts. So that's how I've learned a majority of my life. And then I put books on a shelf because a lot of things started repeating themselves. And you know, like your time is the most valuable thing in the history of the world. So if you're paging through a book after you've read like 800 books and the stuff starts to repeat itself, where it takes you 37 pages to highlight or underline something, shut that book. You're wasting your life. Like, or if it's starting to repeat itself and you're like, well, I learned 7 years ago. Great. It makes you feel good because it feels like you're relearning something, but all it is, you're just reminding yourself. So again, after a while, thanks for listening. Things repeat itself. So now one thing that changed my life for me that really works well for me selfishly is getting around very, very smart, educated, experienced people with high levels of awareness in their fields, no matter what field it is, and asking them very, very specific questions. And I believe that will get me faster inside of solutions, content, questions, wisdom than paging through a book. Because almost a book is worse than a newspaper now. If I'm reading the newspaper, I'm already behind. I'm already behind. If I'm reading a book, it's taken months, years, whatever, to print that copy of stuff. I'm already behind. So I want to be as fast as possible into the future. And I believe it's by spending time with very, very smart people, asking them very, very specific questions, in my opinion.
That's great. And what are some of the best ways, and I guess your opinion, Scott, for other people outside of yourself to learn today? Is it the internet? You know, like you said, is it books to start out with? Is it talking to people? Like what way do you recommend for others to learn?
Yeah. So everyone's read the research on, oh, I'm an audio learner. I learn better visually. I learn better experientially, like all that stuff. All that stuff's great. Right. I think, but people are focused on the wrong stuff. You have to set a very, 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 very unique filter before you let stuff in. So whether you talk to a person, you go online, you read a podcast, or, watch a podcast, whatever it is, it doesn't matter. But you got to set a standard where, okay, it's got to pass some questions. Like, I really believe in Socrates' filter test. So Socrates said back in the day, supposedly, in order to let really valuable information, it's got to pass three tests. So number one is the information's got to be good. Well, that's subjective. Well, what does that mean? Before I read a book, it's got to be good. Before I watch this YouTube video, it's got to be good, right? Before I listen to Matt Bear's podcast, it's got to be good. Well, here's how you define good. It's good enough for Michael Jordan. It's good enough for the president. It's good enough for the CEO for the Timberwolves. It's good enough for Matt Bear. It's good enough for Scott Savor. Like, if it passes
the recommendation, so to speak.
Yes. So if all those people green light it, or the more people that green light it, who absorb a lot of information on a daily basis, it's probably going to be good at a high level. So set your standard really, really high. Don't let information come in. Don't just read a book because it's a bestseller. Like, make sure it checks that box. Is it good? And then another one, is it useful? It's another question to help me. So am I reading a book? Am I talking to someone about something that's going to be useful for me, that's going to provide some stupid utility? Otherwise, what am I doing? Like, I want it to change me. I want to be able to use it. So good, useful. And then the third question is it the truth? Well, that's really subjective. How do I know if something is the truth or not? Well, you can take it through a series of questions, right? So has this been proven? Who's proven it? Is it reproducible for me, right? And I'm trying to carve out whether it's the truth or not. So again, the truth fears no questions. That soundbite changed my life, but that's allowed me to digest content and different educational experiences, different than everyone else. I really believe that.
And I want to get a little bit into the, kind of sports world now, Scott, since that's kind of your forte. What you've worked with a lot of teams, like I mentioned, at different levels, high school on up to the pros. What are some of the really successful people or teams doing that you see that others aren't doing?
Phenomenal question. Again, questions win, answers lose. I want to hang out with people. The famous Matt Bear, anyone who's tripling or doubling their ask to answer ratio. I don't want to hang out with people who have all the answers to everything, because that scares the heck out of me.
Well, I certainly don't have any answers, so that's why I asked the questions.
Okay. Here we go. No, but like, for real, that stuff changed my life. So I believe those solutions are discovered when you discover the end game. So you begin with the end in mind, right? So just because a team won a championship doesn't mean that you should study what they're doing and reproduce what they're doing, in my opinion. Because Matt, you know better than anybody in the sports world, I could be treating players and front office people and everyone like garbage, or at a high school, college, or pro level, it doesn't matter. And we could still be getting a desired outcome or behavior. We still could be winning. We could still be successful, but everyone's just getting dumped on. So just because there's an outcome that looks good doesn't mean I believe we should study the process of what that team provides or what that, organization, whatever it is. So I think that comes from emotional intelligence and awareness and really studying what we want our end game to be, respectfully. So I believe culture is a big deal, but culture really doesn't matter unless you have core values. And core values don't really matter for a team, high school, college, or pro, if they're not held accountable to that. And if they're not clarified and they're not committable and controllable, they're just dead in the water. They don't matter. Like, it doesn't matter. I don't care if you put them on a t-shirt, stamp them on your forehead, tattoo them on your pec. It doesn't matter. Like, they're worthless, right? So there's got to be some identifiable things that are important, kind of like you said, that successful teams do. But then you got to follow through with it. And you got to celebrate them on a daily basis just as much as a dunk and one, a made three, whatever it is, if you're in the basketball world and all the other fun stuff. So values, thanks for listening, is a big deal. Inside of that, accountability, clarity, all that fun stuff, celebrating the process. Again, that's kind of been overused, but I think people – it's just like positivity. People have overused that and beat that into the ground. So now everyone thinks who's positive is soft. So it's like, I'm softer than blue ball ice cream because I'm a positive coach, or you're a positive coach. So then it's like, okay, quit changing the definitions of words. So whatever. So those are some things that jump out initially. Thanks for asking.
So you've worked with a few successful teams, Scott, specifically, Golden State. I know you and I have talked a little bit about your work with them, and then also the Minnesota Lynx. What sort of specific things maybe did you see from either of those teams when you were, hanging around them or spending quality time with those two groups?
Yep, phenomenal. Great question. So very, very easy answer for me. Golden State Warriors, why they were so successful the 4 years I was fortunate to be around with them, had nothing to do with me. It had everything to do with that with Steve Kerr was mindful to create some core values. Okay. Now, were they perfect at demonstrating them? No. But he knew that that was a roadmap for the team to kind of keep people accountable in the front office, on the court, all that good stuff. And then second, I believe what Steve Kerr was really good at is he gave guys a great balance. So one of the reasons why Kevin Durant came from OKC, a lot of people don't know this, to the Golden State Warriors, is because he didn't have a lot of balance in his life. It was all about basketball at OKC, respectfully. And I really believe if you sat down with KD 101, his number one passion in life is not basketball. Doesn't mean he's a bad person. Doesn't mean I have the right answer to what that question would be or anything. Like, he likes video games and he likes to do other stuff. And that's okay. I really think it's okay. And he got more of a balance with the Warriors, and Steve Kerr was prioritizing that. And I think that's why a lot of guys migrated, right, and were magnetized to go to the Golden State Warriors, because you don't get a lot of balance in the NBA. And most coaches are like, basketball 24/7, and they just grind you to a fine powder. And it's like, okay, go have fun. Well, whatever. So that was a big one for the Golden State Warriors, in my opinion, those two things, core values. And, you know, some harmony, some work-life harmony. That Steve Kerr led by example, and I really believe that. And on the Lynx side, it was very interesting. So Cheryl Reeve knows exactly what she wants from a player. And that's what makes it fun, because that clarity is power. So when she brings a player in with a draft, or she sets an expectation in practice and all that stuff, like, it's very, very crystallized, which a lot of coaches don't have that. They just come in and they just keep reminding players what they want. And you're just shooting yourself in the foot, because the players don't know what to grab onto. There's no foundation there. And that's one thing I believe Cheryl was really good at, is accountability with clarity. I'll never forget an example. Thanks for listening. We're watching practice, and I was very, very fortunate to be around a lot of practices and all that good stuff. And point guard would come down for the Lynx during practice, during scrimmage, and she would make a call. She would just call an offensive set out. And Cheryl immediately would be like, no, something, call something else. Right in the middle of the scrimmage. So she'd have to retrace, triple back, and Cheryl would say something else. Hey, call something else. Like, four times in a row, because Cheryl believes so much in preparing the players for anything. And there's not going to be any surprises in the game. There's not going to be any surprises in practice, because we prepare for those type of things. And that clarity, coaches don't have enough. Parents don't even have enough. Front offices don't even have enough. And there's not a better life in the history of the world when you can put some clarity out there inside of what you believe, and then hold people accountable to it and celebrate the heck out of it. So those are some big things that jumped out.
Yeah, I really like what you're saying there, Scott, about the clarity piece. In regards to that, you know, how is the coach responsible in getting that out there? You know, is that something where they observe for a little while just to see how everyone, you know, gets along, or their roles are, and then provide that clarity? Or do they provide that clarity right at the front end and then kind of wait and adjust after?
Great questions. You don't have time to experiment, right? So if you're a coach and you're in a leadership type position, it's going to be really, really difficult for you to prescribe the necessary ingredients for success with your team if you don't know what your truths are. And the primary reason why I've learned, in my opinion, why coaches don't have this, or certain front offices, or certain people in an organization or a high school or college, they don't have those truths, is because they haven't spent enough time on that stuff. Right. And it takes thousands and thousands of hours to find out, hey, what my strengths and non-strengths are, let alone the things that I believe in, how we should behave. So here's our truths. Here's how I think we should communicate to people in 2020. Here's how we should hold people accountable. Here's how we can celebrate that accountability. Here's how we stay simpler than everybody else in this platform, and all the truths that you believe are most important to focus on. But they don't teach us at MIT, Columbia, Princeton, Harvard. It's just like, good luck, Matt. Good luck. I hope you find some clarity by the time you're 95 years old. And then hopefully you can reproduce some of those great clarities and truths with the people you're fortunate to be around. That's not a plan. So again, that's why I'm so excited about that subject, that topic. I really, really believe in that.
And one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Scott, you know, working with college and pro teams, you know, they have a little more control, so to speak, over the players that they have and that they work with. I know you've worked with some high school teams, and, you know, both you and I being from a small town, you know, you don't have as much control over the players that go out for basketball or any sport that are on your team, because in a, for example, a smaller town, you may have two or three kids that are super passionate about being there and really love the game and want to get better at whatever sport it is. And then the rest, you know, are there because they don't want to get in trouble or, you know, want to be around their friends, and they may not share the same passion as others. What are kind of, you know, some advice that you can give to the high school coaches that, you know, maybe don't have as much control over their personnel on establishing that culture and stuff that you talk about so passionately?
Yeah, you already know. You've seen this just as much as I have. You have to be able to give a master's class on development, because if you inherit a certain type of player, maybe you believe what they believe, you don't believe what they believe, whether you're at the collegiate level, the high school level, whatever, you have minimal control in order to retire their jersey, right? And you know that. So you have to be a master developer. You have to be a master at enlightening the players and the coaches you're fortunate to be around and the parents and the people and all that stuff inside of what you believe and why they should believe what you believe. And if you don't have your ducks in a row, if you don't have some clarity inside of what you believe, there's no way you're going to get any player, whether he or she is 12 or 13 years old or 18 or whatever, to drink your Kool-Aid whatsoever, drink the metaphorical Kool-Aid on your program or the things that you believe they should demonstrate at a high level. It's just not going down. But coaches are so fast to complain, like, oh man, like, I can't count on her. She doesn't show up. You know, she's not all in. He's not doing this. And it's so easy to blame, complain, make excuses. But as soon as you open that Pandora's box one time, if I start blaming, complaining, or making excuses one time for a player, for a coach, for my salary, for whatever it is, it's a wrap. It's over for me. I'm done. When I start that complaint train garbage, it's over. So, hey, you got to let go of control, and you got to be able to give a master's class on how to develop other people. But it starts with yourself. Like, you just can't skip steps. You can't do it. I can't do it.
So what you're saying, Scott, like, say, for example, that player on your team's really not into it. What, if I'm hearing you right, your job as the coach then is to get something out of them to make them care more, right? Like, not complain about it and say, you know, she's the problem. It's actually you as the coach that you need to look internally. Is that correct?
Window mirror mentality, right? Look out the window and pass the buck, or look in the mirror, right, and own certain things. They don't know what you know. If someone's 12, 13, 18 years old, however old they are, they don't know what you know. And people say right now, 2020, there's no such thing as common sense. Well, there isn't a lot, because everyone's reminding people of what they should know themselves. Reminding people is not coaching something. Matt, this is the biggest problem right now in coaching at all levels. If you and I are on the floor with someone right now and we're coaching a group of players, whatever level, it doesn't even matter. Boys, girls, doesn't even matter. And we're like, hey, don't forget to do this when this happens. Don't forget to do this. Or, hey, great job, girls. Do this now. Or, boys, great job. Do this. That's not coaching. That's reminding. And then they're dependent upon you or me for the rest of their lives. And that's why it's so frustrating getting players right now at any level, high school, college, or pro, to do the simplest, the most common sense of things, because we haven't been coaching them for the last 10 years. We've been reminding them and thinking that's coaching. Thanks for listening. The most effective thing we can do when we're trying to level up and educate and develop players and people at a high level is praise them for thinking it through and provide opportunities where they can think it through and figure it out. Hey, figure it out. What do you think is the most important thing to do right now, girls? What do you think? Versus saying, hey, now go do this. Now go do this. No, you're completely cutting the umbilical cord when you don't do that. Like, there's so much opportunity out there. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, I would agree. I love that statement and where you're coming from on that, with getting them to think for themselves, because they're probably more likely to retain that as opposed to, oh, what did coach say again? I got to remember that. And then, you know, along with the 50 other things, it's probably all mashed up in there. And when they're on the court, you have to, it's not as quick to think of all that stuff. You got to cycle through your brain and flip those pages. So I know one team you worked with, speaking of the high school level this year, Scott, was the Eden Prairie Boys program and Coach Flum. And obviously they had a tremendous year, best year in school history. They actually finished, some programs, they were top 10 in the country, ESPN and stuff like that, and were undefeated and, you know, had a good shot at winning the state title. What did you like or see working with them and Coach Flum this year in Eden Prairie?
Wow, we got a couple hours to talk about that team and Coach Flum, and I'll respectfully, yeah. So I've been fortunate to be around them for, wow, like 6 years or so right now. And I'm just sharing context. I'm not trying to win a popularity contest. But I have a lot of respect for David because I remember sitting down with him a long time ago and just talking about hoops and talking about what he was not satisfied with and talking about what he wanted to improve and change and prioritize. And he talked about himself a lot. He talked about his coaching staff a lot because he cares about people. And he talked about his players and his program in the community. And he's a very, very unselfish guy, right? And you already know that's a huge step in the right direction. If you can kind of separate yourself from your ego the majority of the time as a coach, great things usually happen. And things just start to show up in a really, really fun, rewarding way. And one thing I respect about David is he's never satisfied ever, right? And just when he could say and pass the baton and make all excuses and do all this, like, no, like he just owns it. He just owns it. If there's a challenge going on or if his team fell short, like he owns it first. And I think that's a really respectful thing. Anyways, they've done some really unique things over the years, and it has nothing to do with me, but it has everything to do with David not being satisfied. I really believe that. His practices are different. The way he communicates to the community and the parents and the players is different. And I'll never forget this. Thanks for listening. And I know he'd be completely okay sharing this, and maybe he shared this before when you guys talked live, but like he has no tacit approval. And a lot of people don't know what this means. Here's exactly what no tacit approval means. If I'm speaking to a group of parents and I'm like, hey, your son, John, hasn't showed up to practice early one time all year. He floats in last second and it's just, he's not present and he's distracted. And for whatever reason, that's a distraction to the team. No tacit approval is me having the courage and the professionalism in an appropriate way to share that with the parents and say, no, we don't do things that way here. It has nothing to do personally with your son, daughter, whoever it is, but I need to have the courage as leading your son as a man or your daughter as a woman in the future that, hey, we can't accept this. And again, I'm just as accountable as they are. And that's one thing David does really well is he shoots. He's a straight shooter and he's not afraid because leaders who are really good at what they do, they don't give a rat's tail how other people react or respond to what they do because they know it's important and it needs to be done. And that's why people are so fragile in certain leadership positions. Thanks for listening. Is because they don't even know what leadership is. Leadership is not contingent. What I do is not contingent upon whether or not Matt Bear likes it or not. It's not. And if it is, I don't know what I'm doing. And I believe what Steve Jobs said. I really believe this, right? Artists lead. People who are artists at what they do, really, really good at what they do, they lead. And hacks ask for a show of hands. Hey, what does everyone think? What do you think we should do next? I still believe in listening to people. But if you don't know what to do next, you shouldn't be in a position of leadership, in my opinion, or be leading large groups of people, whether it's players, coaches, whoever. Thanks for listening.
You bet.
Let's go.
Love it. And Scott, what is one thing, and this could be coaches, this could be, you know, just people in general. What is one thing in current day that people should be paying attention to right now, but they're not? What are they missing out on?
Well, it's already hidden inside your question. Paying attention. We got to stop. We reward people every day for not paying attention. We reward people every single day, intentionally or unintentionally, no matter what level they're at, for not being present.
Meaning?
Taking out their phones, no eye contact, no questions, like no like real true dialogue type thing. Or, hey, I'm 75% here, or having a call with someone, an audio call where I can't see you because you're doing 17 other things. And allowing and bragging about being multitasking and all this other garbage. Like every time you allow someone to not be present, fear sneaks in, fear, because there's no fear in the present because I'm not thinking about the past or the future, right? And there's all kinds of other stuff too. It's unbelievably effective, but again, it's not popular. It's not popular at all, rewarding people to be present. And we just create all these problems and we don't even know we're doing it.
So in other words, being where your feet are.
Yes, sir.
Yep, that, I know that's one big thing personally. Like, I've been trying to work on is when I'm with my family, I'm with my family. You know, when I'm at work, I'm doing my work stuff. You know, I think that's one thing that can really help me or other people is just when you're engaged in a conversation with one person, you're not looking over Scott's shoulder when I'm talking to you to see who the next best person to talk to is. I'm engaged with you and I'm paying attention. I'm giving you the, you know, proper eye contact and respect to continue that conversation.
You wonder what, Matt, great point. You wonder why there's so many problems right now or major problems that have surfaced lately in the world. It's because nobody's really ever listened to the other person across from them ever. Just because I have a heart rate up right now and I have a heartbeat and I'm looking at you and because I can fog a mirror doesn't mean I'm listening. Doesn't mean I'm really hearing you. And we've let that slide, that non-negotiable skill, we've let that slide the last 20, 30 years. And now we're like rewarding it, right, for not being present because we think it's so cool to multitask and it's just the dumbest approach in the history of the world. And now guess what? People are getting so angry because there's not a worse emotional feeling in the history of the world, Matt, right, than when someone doesn't listen to you or you don't feel like they're listening or you don't feel like they care about what you're talking about. That people do stupid stuff when that happens, really stupid stuff. And that's why right now it's starting to bite us in the butt because we haven't rewarded being present. We haven't.
Yeah. How many times are you hearing that? Like you said, Scott, that's a good point, especially today. Oh, my voice isn't being heard. Or, you know, these people aren't paying attention. You hear that constantly now, constantly.
We're solving the wrong problems and we're trying to solve problems at the same level in which they were created. No, thank you, sir. No, thank you.
And I wanted to get back to athletics real quick here, Scott. In regards to youth athletics specifically, you know, like youth meaning middle school, elementary school athletics, maybe even bleeding into high school a little bit. What are your thoughts on the youth sports world these days? Do you like where it's going? Do you think there's too much specialization? Kind of what are your thoughts there on the youth sports world?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So I'm fortunate to meet with well over 1,000 parents every year, whether it's virtually, in person, whatever. Like I have a very different, diverse palette based on how I'm going to answer this question, please. And I'll speak in absolutes. Doesn't mean I'm right. Doesn't mean I have the only way or the only solutions or what I'm about to say is non-negotiable. But I'm telling you, I have a lot of conviction, a lot of belief in what I'm about to say. So people point the finger at parents and all this other stuff. And how can you behave based on things you don't know? We do how we were raised in a lot of cases. Maybe we might read a book on parenting, coaching, whatever, and it might level us up a little bit, whatever. But I believe a lot of people just don't know what to do. I talk to a lot of parents. They're like, hey, I don't know how to raise my kids who are in sports, or they're so afraid to fail, and they're so addicted to happiness through their sport and their performance and their outcomes, and just it's destroying them. It's like they're depressed, and now they can't play sports because of COVID at certain levels, and there's certain things that are taken away. But their whole life, all they've been getting attention for is the happiness they've gotten from their sport after performing the sport and getting an outcome that they wanted. So these are things that I think parents know are problems, but they just don't know how to navigate them. Or a lot of coaches, even at the youth level, grassroots level, they don't know how to navigate them because when they played, but they only know what they know. So there's some really, really major problems out there and some huge opportunities for the youth kids. And I'm telling you right now, 70% are going to pass through sports and get wrecked. It's going to set them up for failure the majority of their life because they're dependent upon their outcomes. And it just keeps getting rewarded every single practice, every single workout, every single game. And then when you take that away from them, whether COVID takes away or the end of their career or the end of their high school season or middle school, or they pivot to a different sport or they don't play sports anymore or whatever, they don't want to act. And that pursuit of happiness through their sports at the youth level is what wrecks people. And parents don't know how to navigate it respectfully.
So does that go back to kind of what you were talking about with, you know, Golden State and Coach Kerr, Scott, in regards to blending on the court and off the court stuff, you know, like, hey, here, you enjoy this off the court, go ahead and do that. But when you're here on the court, we're going to get down to business, but let's hear about what you're doing off the court. Oh, that's awesome. You're, you know, love playing video game or whatever it might be, you know, just having that balance.
Yes. Phenomenal. So I believe one of the biggest things you can ever demonstrate to a youth athlete is this. They're responsible for their own happiness and their own joy. I'm responsible for my own happiness, my own joy. I don't care if you make 17 baskets in a row. I know it feels good. It affects you. You're not a robot. I'm not a robot. But when you can release and hold them accountable to that responsibility. You're responsible for your happiness. You're responsible for your attitude, your effort, your focus, all those controllable type things. It allows them to be the best version of themselves in their sports if they happen to play sports. But most adults have never been given that right to be responsible for their own happiness. They always let the world and what happens outside of them, whether it's how their kids act, don't act, whatever, determine their happiness. And guess what? I will always be the prisoner of everyone or the basketball or the scoreboard who I allow to determine my joy and happiness. No, thank you, sir.
Yeah, that's powerful. I believe that, Scott. That's a great measuring stick for that, for sure. So for the people that don't know, Scott, you work with teams, individuals, companies. We get a lot of basketball coaches and families and people that listen to this podcast. What are some things that you bring to the table when you partner with a basketball team or an individual? What sort of things do you look to accomplish with them?
Yeah, no, thanks for asking. So we select a skill or a situation they're trying to maximize. So if it's an individual, team, or a company I'm fortunate to work with, we start there and we look at what's front-facing, right? What's most essential right now? Is it a skill that someone needs to level up in or the situation that you're trying to maximize? And we start with questions. So we try to peel that onion layers deeper than anyone has ever had before, because I believe nothing really gets accomplished on the surface. So we got to go layers deep by asking very different strategic questions. And then we identify that skill or situation that we're trying to maximize. And we move the needle towards where we believe the aggressive realities are in that situation. I'm so fortunate and spoiled, man. I get to work with coaches all levels, CEOs, executives, players, parents. Unbelievable. Hey, I'm trying to help my kid have contagious confidence. What would you do? Can you spend a call with me a week, a call with them a week? Can you work them on the court? I do some skill development stuff in, you know, different scenarios that are specific, because the kids learn when they feel it, right? They don't learn. They don't care what I say. They don't care what you say. They care when they feel something. And can you help them feel how fun it can be to be a leader, or how fun it can be to be contagiously confident during the most non-optimal environments? Or, you know, thanks for listening, different examples with teams. Like, we have the worst culture in the history of the world. Where would you start? Okay. Well, here's some things to think about. Here's what some other companies do, teams do, that you can reproduce in your situation. So there's just a lot of fun cases and examples, unfortunately, a part of.
And when I was kind of looking at your website and everything, Scott, I know one thing that you talk a lot about is being different. Can you give us maybe some examples of ways that you've seen people succeed at being different?
Oh, we got till midnight, respectfully, sir. Let's go. Let's go. I'm telling you, being different is a difference. Hopefully I demonstrate that at a high level. So the more you can do things differently, and I believe in what Mark Twain said, when you find yourself on the side of the masses, you need to step back and reflect, because the masses leads towards mediocrity. If you spend money, if you invest money, if you wake up, if you go to sleep, if you eat food the same as everyone else, that scares me. Like, no disrespect to anyone who has a best-selling book too, like you and I have talked about this format. Like, you need to question anything that is similar to the masses on any aspect of your life, how you live, how you work, how you play, everything. I'm so addicted right now, hopefully I demonstrate this in a respectful way, to doing the exact opposite of everyone else. So I eat a prison burrito every 30 days. That's why I read books out loud, or I read things I'm reading out loud so I can record them. Then I can play them back when I work out and exercise and habit stack those two things. Because everyone makes excuses. Well, I don't have time to do this. Well, or I can't retain this. Well, you haven't habit stacked things that can help you. And you don't know the skills or the strategies to bundle those together to maximize your time anyways. So there's just a lot of fun opportunity out there doing the exact opposite of everyone else. And hopefully I'll never change.
Let's talk about this prison burrito, Scott. What's that about?
Okay, here we go. You open up the can of worms, sir. You open up the Pandora's box. Here we go. So I believe in, once you have a certain level of abundance in your life or access to things, which a lot of us have, whether it's financially, abundance to time, whatever it is, you know, I can eat a five-star breakfast, lunch, and dinner every single day. Okay. We're fortunate enough where we can do that. But I know that that'll destroy me and destroy my family if I don't eat something a little less desirable intentionally. That's why I eat a prison burrito. It's not nutritionally the most beneficial thing in the world. You got like ramen noodles and Doritos and Cheez-Its and, right? But it's ingredients you can get out of a prison if you're a prisoner. It was just kind of a fun thing I discovered one day. And then I want to celebrate doing more with less. I want to celebrate not having to be entitled to certain types of food or a certain type of house or car or whatever it is. Like, I think it all blends together. It's all camouflage. It's all smoke and mirrors anyways at the end of the day. If you study high performers who are healthy, who have been at the end of their life, they'll all tell you the same stuff. All of it's a lie. All of it's a lie. All your cars you drive, house, all that stuff. It's just all, and again, there's nothing wrong with having really expensive stuff or however you want to define that, but it's no different than being too good for certain food items or being too good for a certain scenario or an experience or an item. Or it's all garbage. It's all distraction. So in my opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting. You hear about people doing that every now and then, you know, like you said, Scott, eating the prison burrito, or, you know, maybe they'll go spend a night outside in a cardboard box or something like that to remind them, you know, hey, here's what someone less fortunate might have to go through. I don't have to go through this on a daily basis, but I want to experience it so I know how fortunate I am to have what I have.
Man, I love it. And could I share something too to that point, please?
For sure.
This changed my life. And I don't care if other people think it's weird. I'm like, yes, yes. I want people to think that everything that we do is weird. Everything that I do is weird. So like, we'll spend half a day in a cemetery. I really believe this. Because we have two choices. I can go through life and say, hey, look at how grateful I am. I'm really grateful for this. I appreciate this, whatever, whatever. And I could maybe be satisfied with that level of gratitude or whatever, whatever. And then a death in the family happens. Something bad happens to me physically, whatever it is. And it takes away something that I was grateful for, but maybe not at the level that I could be, right? So I can walk around and wait for something tragic to happen to me or a family, friend, whatever it is. And then it's like, whoa, maybe I should do things a little bit differently now, okay? Or I can intentionally spend a half a day in the cemetery, go to a children's hospital when appropriate, you know, all this stuff, whatever it is, eat a prison burrito, do more with less, hang out in a tent instead of sleeping in your $5 million house, whatever it is, right? And elevate, hopefully, my gratitude, my awareness, and all the other stuff, appreciation, and not have to let the world do it. To me, that's just intelligence. I'm not perfect at it, but I really, really believe, I drink the Kool-Aid out of a cement truck on that philosophy. And it's just not popular. You know, it's not in the papers, it's not online, you don't read it about it on Twitter. I don't care. I don't care.
And when you look at leaders, Scott, I know you, a big platform of yours is leadership. Who are some of the best or top line leaders that you've observed? Can you give us maybe two or three that you really hold in high regard and think are just phenomenal at being leaders in their field?
Sure. So let me put a disclaimer out there, please. I don't have favored people. I have favored behaviors. And hopefully I demonstrate that.
Sure. Like, sure.
You already know if I put someone's name out there and they're like, oh, well, he's a scumbag or she did this or she, and then, oh, you're saying they're a leader. Well, okay. I'm not the referee to say, okay, this person is the best leader in the world and this person isn't. But I tell you, I can pick apart some things that I think some people that you'd like, man, they don't know. Why would you put a leadership tag on that person? Because we're picking our teachers. Matt, you know this. As soon as I wake up tomorrow, I'm like, oh, he's a leader. She's not a leader. He isn't. And I start picking my teachers. I'm in trouble. If I let how much I like them or dislike them persuade the value in which I can learn from them, I'm in trouble. And that's everybody's doing this because it's chemical. Because you listen to people who make you feel good. And it's all a lie. Magical things happen when you don't pick your teachers. And you kind of let everybody in, put your shield, your flamethrowers, your swords away. And just, hey, you can teach me something. I think you're a scumbag, but you can teach me something or whatever. So anyways, I just did a talk on some unique long-term traits of leaders, right? And one thing I talked about was exact behaviors of certain people. So Rosa Parks, she had the courage to do the exact opposite of everyone else and make that decision, which transformed the whole world of, right, what's going on in the world right now. Talked about MLK leadership, how he had levity, brevity, and repetition when he gave speeches and talks. That's really, really a big deal. That's a heck of a leadership skill. I'm going to steal that from MLK. I'm going to steal the courage piece from Rosa Parks. Then we talked about Captain Sully, who landed the U.S. Airways plane, and he was prepared enough where he could make decision 3 versus decision 1 or 2 and land the plane on the Hudson River. right? That's a skill I want to suck from him. And it just happens to be, you know, a pilot from US Airways, right? So I think we got to stop getting away from, okay, this person's got great leadership skills, whatever, whatever, and just find something in people, like get really creative and dig down, because I can give you a million of them. Michael Phelps, you're like, oh, whoa, this, whatever, whatever about him. He trained 5 years in a row, never missed a workout. I want that leadership skill of consistency from Michael Phelps. Let's go. I got to be more consistent. That's embarrassing. 5 years, never missed a workout. So if you pay attention to it, thanks for listening. You'll find it in every single person you meet, in every single situation you do, if you keep your radar up. It's all over.
And then I know you mentioned core values a lot, Scott, and how important core values are. What are some of your core values personally that you have?
Sure. So again, doesn't mean they're right. Doesn't mean they're the only way, but I really believe in questions. So what we did is we identified as a family some core values, and then we'd frame them up into questions, controllable questions. So one would be, we have a checklist, we have it framed on our wall, and because we believe in this. Like if we see it, we pay attention to it, we prioritize it. Okay. So we walk up and you see it every time when you go up to bed at night and every time when you come down the stairs in the morning. So it's a priority. And we're not perfect at our core values, but we believe in it and we prioritize them. So like one core value question we would have is, hey, did I learn something new today and teach someone? That would be one. Like we really believe in that. Another one is, hey, did I make my health a priority for 30 or more minutes today? That's another core value question we have. And again, these are 100% controllable, 100%. And we can commit to them. We can celebrate them, all that fun stuff. You just keep going down the list. Did I pay attention to the 1 minute rule? So the 1 minute rule is trying to be present to the 1 minute. So you and I are having a conversation and we're like, hey, we're talking about hoops. And you're like, oh, by the way, I'm going to go eat lunch over here and do it. I'm like, Matt, are you present to the 1 minute rule? Are we talking about what's inside this 1 minute we've talked about in the past or the future? So again, that's another question that we have, a little subjective, but we believe in it. And I could just keep going down the list. So we have 12 questions that we really, really believe in as a family. And hopefully we demonstrate them at a high level.
Oh, that's great. I love that. Especially like you said, having them on the wall or, you know, what have you in your house. So people see that and identify it. We'll kind of get towards the end of the show here, Scott. And I'd like to do a fun little part called the bear trap. A little play on my last name where I get a couple, you know, just quick hitter questions here for you. But basketball wise, if you could add or change one rule in basketball, what would it be?
Any level,
yeah.
I would like to see one game where nobody celebrates outcome. That's a really weird answer, I'm telling you. but you literally demotivate every single player you work with when you celebrate a made basket. It's unbelievable. Try to find everything to celebrate that's controllable up until that made basket. It's like this, I have to share this, please. Never tell a player, hey, good shot, after they make it. Tell them before or in the middle of the shot. Okay. Make or miss, it doesn't matter. If they made a good decision to make a good shot, whether it's a layup, a paint touch, whatever it is, a corner three, if you're in the NBA, WNBA, whatever it is, don't say good shot after they make it. Say good shot, whether they make or miss, right, as they're going into the motion or after the fact. And that's where everybody messes up. That's what I mean by stop celebrating the outcomes. And you literally increase motivation times 100x. It's unbelievable.
Is that where it goes to the clarity like we were talking about, Scott? Like setting that up beforehand so you know it's a good shot when you're taking it because you've worked on that every day in practice or, you know, coaches talked about that. Is that kind of fair for what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay, awesome. Number two, most memorable game. I know you've been around a lot of sporting events in your life here, Scott, but most memorable game you've ever been at or participated in, been a part of?
Wow. There's a laundry list, but again, this is my opinion. I remember being a strength coach at University of Detroit, and we played Duke at Duke, their first game of the season. And we were up 15-1 against them. And like you could hear a pin drop at Cameron Indoor Stadium. And again, we got lucky and they blasted us, I think, by 30 or whatever at the end of the game. We got lucky out of the gate. But, I've been fortunate to be in WNBA, NBA finals type situations. And, but I've been fortunate to be in amazing high school games too. So I love the question. I respect it. And it connects us in stories. But if I scale this game was better than this one, then I won't have fun going to the next high school practice that I go to or the next, you know what I mean? So I'm with you. Like, and there's a lot of fun stories. I know you got a ton too.
Yep. There you go. Thinking differently again. I love it. Okay. So last one we always ask our guest, Scott, is your five favorite basketball players of all time. Okay. So it doesn't have to be by position. You don't need a center, a guard, a four, you know, like that sort of thing. So who are your five favorite players of all time?
Well, I feel like that's an impossible question, sir.
And if you want, I can give you mine just for a frame of reference. And
why you know what? I'd love to hear yours, please. Okay. Matt. Yeah, please.
So sure. I've got Michael Jordan, Steve Nash, Penny Hardaway, Larry Bird, and Kevin Garnett. And I think the interesting thing is when I ask a lot of guests this question, you can learn a lot about just how old they are, because most of the time people are their favorite players that they navigate or are drawn to are in their developmental years. You know, when you're 8 to 18, somewhere in there. And I think it's just kind of funny how that works out for a lot of people. So how about you?
Yeah, heck yeah. Wow. There's so many. I immediately think of Michael Jordan because when I was younger, I've never had this feeling. I would watch him shoot a shot and I would hold my breath. And it was really weird. He had that much influence over me, and maybe just because I was young and I loved hoops so much. But I just felt like he provided a different feel to the game, and it was very hypnotizing almost. And was he the best in the world? I don't know what best in the world means because everyone hasn't played against everyone and they never will, but whatever, whatever. So MJ pops out first. On the women's side, Maya Moore's really impacted me a lot. Lindsay Whalen's really impacted me a lot too. And you know this, you've been around them enough, just first class people. And they just happen to be great basketball players too and all that fun stuff. They just demonstrated some things that were really unique in the basketball game that's absolutely necessary and needed. Other people that would jump out, just because I've done a project and done a lot of research on Kobe Bryant, doesn't mean he's my favorite player, but I have a ton of respect for how he did things and what he was trying to do moving forward towards the end of his career. And, you know, I got to do a video. It took like 500 hours. It was crazy. And studying and researching and going and talking to a lot of people about who was around Kobe and finding the best video on Kobe whatsoever, and create a video that was 30 minutes long on Mamba mentality, on everything that Kobe did that was very different from being a parent to, you know, coaching his daughter to being a player. Just really, really good stuff. So I had a ton of respect for how he impacted the game. And then, I mean, the list could be so long. We could just keep going.
Okay. No, that's fair enough. I like that. So that really brings us to the end of the show here today. Scott, thanks so much for joining us. And could you maybe give people the spots they can find out more about you, Scott, or learn or hear more about, you know, your thoughts and ideas?
Thanks for asking, sir. Smoke and mirrors. I believe in real relationships. Here's my cell phone number, 248-217-9725. That's not my business cell. That's not some my personal assistant cell phone number. It's my real cell phone number, 248-217-9725. I believe in real relationships. I just happen to have a website, scottsavore.com. Who cares? You know, I'm on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. Who cares? But I want real relationships. Text me. Give me a call. All that good stuff. And, you know, again, if I listed off Matt, and I, again, honored, I appreciate our relationship so much. If I listed off all the amazing people who have helped me in my life, who have showed up, like the list is so long that we'd all be dead before I'd finish naming everyone off. So if there's anything I can ever do to help anyone out, highest, you know, individual, team, or company, I've been extremely fortunate. And, you know, whatever I can do, just say it. So, yep, formally or informally.
And I love hearing you say that, Scott, about the relationships piece. You know, a lot of the guests that I've had on so far, pretty successful people, you know, coach of the year, players of the year, stuff like that. And I ask them a lot of times, you know, what are some of the things you enjoy most, or, you know, that you think are a big key to your success? And virtually all of them have said relationships. It's all about relationships. And, you know, hearing you say that too, you know, how much do you feel that's important to your life and what you do every day?
Yeah, it's not negotiable. Again, it's not easy. We can't bat 1,000 every day in that space, but you know, it's something you want to pursue. One thing I respect about you, Matt, a ton is that we've known each other for how many years now? I mean, it's been a while, right? Mm-hmm. It's been a minute, but I've never been around you at a time ever when you could have had every reason whatsoever to be crabs in a bucket, this negative person, suck the energy out of someone. Like, you just tried to find an optimistic, positive approach inside of whatever was going down, whatever we were talking about, whatever, whatever. And you demonstrate a level of humility like we just talked about, that is a big deal. And you haven't wavered. Tony Dungy taught me this. He goes, try to catch someone out of character. Matt, I haven't caught you out of character yet. Doesn't mean I'm the referee, but just giving you a little feedback, sir. Let's go.
Appreciate that.
Appreciate you, sir.
Like you said, I'm not perfect or any leader in that area, but you know, you try. Everyone has bad days. Everyone has good days, but you know, the better you can do it each and every day, I think it only helps, because people want to be around people that hopefully make them feel good and feel better. Sure. So I know the feeling's mutual with you. That's why I always enjoy our conversations and, you know, picking your brain and learning from you too. So thanks so much for being on here, Scott. And I hope to see you around here soon.
Matt, appreciate you so much. Great to catch up. Keep doing what you're doing, sir.
Thanks, man.